is called Turning Towards Emptiness. And these talks are all from the book The Way It Is, which is teachings from the winter retreat of 1988. Turning Towards Emptiness. By reflecting, you bring into consciousness the state of conditions as they happen to be now. Having been born, we're now this age, feeling this way, at this time, and in this place. That's the way it is. That cannot be changed by us. It's just the inevitability of birth that this is the way it is now. And when you realize this, you have a perspective on the way it is, rather than a reaction to the way it is. If you don't reflect, you just react to the way it is. If you're feeling happy, you get high. I want to be a monk for the rest of my life and devote myself to the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the way for me, the only way, the true way. And you go out and bore people with a harangue on the importance of Buddhism in the world because you're high and you feel positive and confident. Even that feeling of being inspired and confident and full of faith and devotion and all those kinds of things, that's the way it is. One can feel a lot of faith, confidence in what one's doing, or one can feel the opposite. One loses faith, one feels that this is a waste of time. I've wasted my life, it's of no value, I haven't got anywhere, hasn't done anything for me, I don't believe in it anymore, I'm fed up with it. Or one can feel indifference. It's all right, don't know what else to do, better than working in a factory. Whichever way you're feeling now, either extreme or just indifference, that's the way it is. So way that Lumpur began here, I think it's helpful to get clear in one's mind what we mean by reflection and what we mean by reaction. And so using the word react, that at least in the way it's used in Dhamma teachings like this, it's a kind of automatic unconscious, way that we relate to things that we like, we chase after them, things that we dislike, we run away from them or oppose them. And so that there is a lack of mindfulness. There's an automatic, an unconscious, habit that is being that's being employed. When we talk about reflection, or often using the word response as a contrast to reaction, then that always implies a quality of mindfulness. There's an awareness of, oh, this is the feeling of liking, or this is a feeling of worrying, this is a feeling of disliking. There's a spaciousness around that. So when we talk about reflection, it implies that quality of perspective. There's a recognition of what's going on. There's an attention to the mind state. It might be so strong that you can't just switch it off. Like there's something that's really off-putting or shocking or disgusting, and you find yourself physically recoiling or turning away. That's but also that kind of automatic way that the physical system responds to something unpleasant or painful, like ow, you burn your hand. It's not like if you're being responsive or reflective. It's interesting. The hand is burning. Lots of pain. The smoke coming off my fingers. Curious. The hand pulls away from the heat source, but there's that mindfulness of what's going on. So having that clear contrast between reaction and reflection, I think, is good to bear in mind. And so when we use the word react, generally that means there's an unconscious or an unmindful habit that's being followed that we call what's pleasant, good, and worthy of holding and keeping, staying, getting close to, and what we call bad or a problem we want to get away from, we want to get rid of it, and we tend to take those liking and disliking, owning or fearing and such like as absolute qualities. This is beautiful, that is ugly, this is mine, that's something that's frightening, And we unconsciously give those qualities of goodness or badness or attractiveness or off-puttingness, we give those qualities as absolute values to the things that are perceived. If there's reflection, if there's a responsivity, then the mind recognizes, oh, this liking and disliking, fearing and wanting and such like, those are necessarily dependent. They're based on the conditioning of this living system, these particular perceptions. So then what Lumpur is emphasizing here, this, and this gave the title to the whole book, you know, The Way It Is, he emphasizes that here over and over again, whether we're inspired rather than getting lost and carried away with our inspiration, or if we are, say, uninspired, we're desperate and getting lost in our desperation, our disappointment and lack of faith, or, as he says, indifference, you know, you know, it's all right being here at Amaravati, don't know what else to do, better than working in a factory. That kind of not really caring. That if we're going to apply the practice, if we're going to work with our experience in a skillful way, then there's a recognition, oh, this is the feeling of being really inspired, everything is great, I love these people, this is a fantastic place, what else could I possibly be doing of value with my life? That's what this feeling is in this moment, is you're very positive, enthusiastic, filled with faith. Or, you know, I've wasted my life, this is of no value, this is, I'm not getting anywhere, hasn't done anything for me. Again, not believing the content of the thoughts, but recognizing, oh, this is what it's like when faith disappears, when there's disappointment, or no matter how hard I try, I never get any kind of rewarding or pleasant, beneficial experience from this. It's all a waste of time. Oh, this is the it's all a waste of time feeling. That's what this is. And so there's that recognition of this is a mind state. This is not an absolute fact. It's not an absolute reality. It's this pattern in this moment. So just notice when you're feeling positive and tremendously energetic, or when there's a lack of energy and you're too critical. When you're depressed, tired, or not feeling very well, it's hard to arouse the inspired feeling. In those circumstances, you tend to pick up on what's wrong with things very quickly. The way somebody walks across a room can really irritate you. Somebody blows their nose too hard, and ugh, that's disgusting. But when you're feeling full of inspiration and devotion, you don't care about the faults of this or that. You're caught up in this feeling of devotion and faith. These perceptions are to be reflected on as the way it is now. It has to be this way because it can't be any other way at this moment. We feel like this. We feel tired or invigorated or whatever. This is the way it is. These are the results of having been born and living our lives and being subject to changing conditions of sensuality. And as I've said a few times over, when Lumpur uses these kinds of expressions, and there was a question the other day, I think from Roman, asking about this, the principles of sort of just watching or being aware, when Lumpur says things like, this is the way it is now, it has to be this way because it can't be any other way at this moment, that can seem like a very fatalistic perception, or a sense of everything is predestined, or there's some kind of in a way a sacred quality to this. It's just, oh, it's this way, it's got to be this way, it's meant to be this way. But over and over again, I like to emphasize that our capacity to act and to make choices in the present moment is also part of the way it is. When you're feeling heat and seeing smoke rising from your fingers, then your capacity to pull your hand away is part of the way it is. the recognition of what's harmful, what's beneficial, what's noble, what's ignoble, that's part of the way it is. And so we're not sort of setting our body, our mind, our life as apart from the whole living system of the natural world, of the natural order. And so that what Lumpur is talking about in this way. It's a very, it's like a very immediate perspective. It's the kind of Akaliko Dhamma perspective. In this exact moment, it's precisely this way. And then we can watch the mind making a choice and choosing to move towards the good or away from the harmful. And in each of those moments, it's exactly this way in this moment. So it's in a sense, it's based on that quality of timelessness and attunement. So it's not a fatalistic, say, perception of like, oh, well, there's this pain in my knee. I determined to sit here for 3 hours, and my knee is on fire. So you know, I should just be with this excruciating, painful feeling. And that, and if I change my posture, then that's interfering with the way things are, isn't it? I would say that your recognition that the knee is in serious trouble and this intense pain probably indicates there's damage being done. The choice to respond to that by changing the posture is also part of the way things are. It doesn't necessarily have to be some kind of intrusion or departure from attunement to the way things are, but it can be just the mind being sensitively aware of the limitations of the living condition. So I think it's really important to understand that teaching, like, you know, this is the way it is, or just, you know, being with open to the way things are, it's not a passivity, it's not a kind of freezing of one's responsivity, but rather it's a precise moment by moment attunement, and so I've said that so many times. I think people have probably got the point, but I feel it's a very significant element to bear in mind, because it can seem that way. It can make us say follow a what they call fatalistic attitude. Oh, this wrenched knee and the necessity for me to sit on a chair for the next 10 years, that's part of the way things are. It's like, well, or you could look at it that way, but you could also see it's the karmic result of having made a choice to not respond to the pain and the sense of strain in the body in a different way, in a way that sort of was more attuned to the limitations of what the body was is capable of. But Lumpur goes on to say, then note, what you add to the existing conditions. In all-night sittings, you may feel sleepy or tired. Note what you add to that feeling. Note the feeling itself, but maintain a posture, rather than just react to feeling tired from an attempt to annihilate the feeling by following it and sinking into lethargy. When you're convinced that you're so tired, there's really nothing you can do about it, and even pulling your body straight is something that seems totally impossible, hold it up straight for a length of time. Observe and learn how much energy it takes to hold a body up. Also, you might have recognized it doesn't have to be during an all-night sitting when your body is slumping and wanting to head downwards, and that we're lacking energy and the whole system seems to be exhausted. But it's a way, what he's speaking about is a way of very closely observing what, as he says, what the mind adds to the existing conditions, and that that's something that is, say, it takes a lot of work, really, to be attentive to the judgments that the mind is making. Like, oh, this is awful, I really should do this, or oh, this is great, I want to do more of that. I want to get more of this experience. Just the continual commentary and say the getting excited and interested and carried away, or getting worried or irritated, that so much of the dukkha that the mind creates is through what it adds on to the present moment experience, pleasant, painful, or neutral. And that the more that there's a sense of, well, in this moment it's this way, in this moment it's this way, there's a great spaciousness when we're not either creating those kind of commentaries, or if they're there, not believing in them, not buying into them. and just noticing the raw quality of the experience. Because often painful experiences are not that bad. Experiences of fear or worry, they're not that bad. Experiences of what we call pleasure, you know, that a delicious taste or a comfortable sensation. That you know, the thinking mind might say, "Oh, this is really great. This is so delicious. This is exactly how I like it." Or, "Oh, this is really comfy. I really like this." When you bring your attention to that, or say gratifying some kind of desire, that when you again, when you look at it, it's just that perception, that sensation in that moment. It's not really that special or that fantastic. Sometimes it's not even that pleasant. So being caught up in gratifying a desire, getting something that you really like. Yes, this is great, this is fantastic. If you put the commentary aside and just notice what that feeling is like of getting the thing that you like, it's like, oh, this is not that special, not so wonderful. Or why do I spend so much time and make so much effort to have this experience? It's not that kind of delightful or pleasant. Is actually quite stressful. Or particularly for myself, I found with fear, I was very very anxious, very fearful by habit, and spent a huge amount of time and energy trying to not be afraid, not be anxious, and not be worried. And that when following this kind of advice, you know, during this very retreat that Lumpur Sumedho was leading in back in 88 and around that time, it was really an eye-opener for me that when looking at the experience of fear and worry and just feeling that as on the mental side, also on the physical side, one of the things that was really striking was like, wow, I spent so much time and effort trying to get away from this worried feeling. And when you really look at it and notice it and take it as a felt experience, it's really not that bad. Why do I spend so much time and effort trying to not feel this? It's not even as bad as a headache or a stone in the shoe. It's really not that uncomfortable. And I kind of felt ripped off. How many years have I spent trying to not feel this? And what have I done? How much, before I was a monk, how much did I drink? You know, how much alcohol did I consume to not be feeling this? When you actually experience that worry as a physical sense or as a mental formation, it's like, what's the big problem? Why was this so awful? Why was this so unbearable? And the reason why was because the mental side adding a whole that aspect to it and getting lost in the content of the worries. But when you let go of the content and you just feel and know that the process of worrying mentally and physically, it was astonishing. Like, wow, it's really not that much. And so that brings a clarity and a simplicity, particularly with emotional reactions of loving something, being caught up in a desire for something that's attractive or beautiful in terms of a person or in terms of foods or sounds or colors and ideas, that when that's being gratified, again, you just say, what? Well, in itself, in that actual sensory experience, why is this so special? Why do I put so much effort into just wanting this particular taste or this particular texture or getting close to that particular form? Big deal. And not creating negativity, but just the sense of, my goodness, what was all the fuss about? Why was I spending so much time and energy just to have this particular taste or that particular texture? And so there's a simplicity, a spaciousness around the sensory world that we don't experience when the mind is just following its habits and getting lost in its say conditioning and the perceptions that we've become accustomed to liking and disliking and fearing and so forth. So any questions, thoughts, perceptions? Okay, carry on. How much energy does it take to stop the thinking process? Have you ever noticed that? Just can't stop thinking. The mind goes on and on. Can't stop. What can I do? I don't know how to stop thinking. It just keeps going. I can't stop it. I know about this because I've always had a problem with a mind that just seemed to be endlessly thinking about something. And the desire to stop thinking and the effort to get rid of it create the conditions for more thinking. It takes effort to do this, not just thinking about doing it. I remember an Australian Abhidhamma fanatic once came to Wat Bapong. This man had a mission. When Westerners get into Abhidhamma, they become like born-again Christians. But he didn't know how to meditate. He didn't believe that meditation worked. And he figured it all out with his Abhidhamma concepts. He felt that you couldn't stop thinking. He said, "You're always thinking and you can't stop thinking." I said, "But you can stop thinking." And he said, "No, you can't." And I said, "I've just stopped thinking." And he said, "No, you can't." And then he said, "No, you haven't." It was pointless to go on talking to someone like that. You have to be alert to know when you're not thinking. So you take an actual thought like, "I can't stop thinking," and you deliberately think it. This is what I did, because I was a habitual, obsessive thinker. So, if you are averse to thinking, instead of trying to stop, go to the other extreme and deliberately think something. And watch yourself deliberately thinking, so that it's not just a wandering thought process in which your mind goes around and around in circles. Use your wisdom faculty. Deliberately think something, some thought that is completely neutral and uninteresting, like, "I am a human being." Deliberately think it, but observe the space before your thinking, and then deliberately say, "I am a human being." Then note the end of the thought, the moment when you stop thinking. Pay attention to the moments before and after the thought, rather than to the thought itself. Just hold attention on where there is no thought. Investigate the space around the thought, the space where the thought comes and goes, rather than thinking. Then you'll be aware of an empty mind, where there's just awareness but no thought. That may last for just a second because you start grasping, so you just have to keep being more aware by thinking something again. With practice, you can use even very unpleasant thoughts. For example, you might have strong emotional feelings of, "I'm no good, I'm worthless." And they can be an obsession. In some people's minds, they can become a background to their lives. So you try thinking, "I shouldn't think that. Venerable Samatha says I'm good, but I know I'm no good." However, if you take that obsession and use it as a conscious thought, "I am no good," you start seeing the space around it, and it no longer sounds so absolute. When it becomes obsessive, it sounds absolute, infallible, the honest truth, the real truth. This is what I really am. I'm no good. But when you take it out of the context of obsession and think it deliberately, intentionally, you see it objectively. That sense of me and mine is just a habit of the mind. It's not the truth. If you really take the I am, and look at it objectively, the feeling created by that I am, and I am this way, or I should be, should not be, is very different from when you're just reacting. So this is a very significant practice, and I was extremely grateful for Lumpur teaching this in those years. Again, having a mind that likes to chatter away by habit. And so this is a method I really recommend. As he says, it's quite different if you just relate to thought as when the mind is chattering away and you want to just make it shut up. And then when it does go quiet, then you sort of grasp hold of that quietness and you fear the thinking coming back in, then it's a sort of a stop-go compulsive experience. But instead of trying to push thought away and then regretting when it's overtaken the mind, then to instead turn towards it and to deliberately learn how to perceive thought as a mental object. Well, we tend to relate to thought as a very different sensory experience than sight, sound, smell, taste or touch. And we put it in a different category. But in Buddhist psychology, thinking is just another sense object. You know, the eye sees, perceives light, the ears perceive sound, and the mind perceives thought. It's just another sense object. It doesn't have a sacred position as it tends to do in our Western appreciation or understanding of things. And so this way of like learning to recognize thought simply as a sense object, using this kind of a neutral statement, so that you're wanting to be able to know thought without getting lost in it. You take something very bland and non-personal, like I am a human being, or I often would take something like today is Thursday, or this month is March. You know, it's like there's no emotional loading. It's not personal. It's not anything about you as an individual or anything that's very questionable. It's not really up for sort of debate or discussion. It's a very, very simple statement. And as he says, you make it a deliberate exercise. Try to focus the attention as fully as possible. Notice the space before the thought forms, and then just deliberately think that sentence: I am a human being, or today is Thursday, or this month is March. And then noticing that shape, just like looking at the microphone and seeing the round shape of the microphone and the straight shape of the bar, you know, and the color of the blackness of the microphone against the pale gray of the tiles. Okay, there's a form, there's a color, there's these particular combination of features. So in exactly the same way, there's a word and there's silence, and there's a word: today is Thursday, and silence after that. So there's no big difference, no huge contrast between a thought form in speech or in the mental world, visual forms, visible forms to the eye, or the sound of a word. Silence, word, silence. And that there's a space and then a form and then a space. So then by using a bland statement like I'm a human being or today is Thursday and so on, then you begin to see how there can be a thought, but there's still spaciousness around that. It's like the microphone and the bar don't fill the whole space of the temple here. Similarly, the thought today is Thursday is just there within the space of the mind. It's not absolutely all and everything. If you absorb into the content of the thought and when it's more emotionally charged, like, you know, I'm no good, or I'm worthless, or I am special, then when it's got something more personal to it, or there's an emotional quality that's in it, then the attention more gets drawn to the content of the thought. But as Lumpur suggests here, with practice, then even those emotionally loaded or much more personal thoughts, where the attention gets lost in the content, it can still maintain just a clear awareness of the process of a thought form of I'm no good, or I am special, or I am ordinary. I'm completely average. The mind can still perceive those as objects arising, taking shape and dissolving in space. And so that what you're doing is you're learning to be aware of thought as a process without getting lost in the content of it. And then with that sense of knowing how thought, thinking arises, takes shape and dissolves, then there's a much greater capacity to be mindful of it, to not get lost in the content. And then you can use this kind of practice in many and various ways. And so just looking into the as he said in that last little part about the I am feeling, and to recognize this, even if you take a thought like I am, or your name than to just repeating your name or the I am or just I. And looking at that and knowing that simply as a thought form. And also you can use it as a direct support for developing the insight, particularly into not self, because something like I or I am or our name, there's so much attachment, there's so much, say, conditioning around that, I am, this is me, this I'm a person, this is what I am, this is my nature, when we start to see those literally just as thought forms and patterns of conditioning, then it opens up the heart to that, the insight of what the word I is referring to, that when we think of our name, what is the referent, what is this that the name is referring to? Ooh. And so it can be a very direct trigger, a kind of doorway into the insight into not self, that the mind recognizes that your name is just a convention, it's just a way of labeling a particular pattern of experience and what we call a person. Similarly, our name, all the memories and the ideas and the feelings and so on, the conditioning around the family and our history that goes along with the name, similarly, just that quality of perspective and seeing the empty nature of those perceptions, that can be triggered, that can be catalyzed by looking at that, rather than just hearing our name or thinking I am and just taking that as a solid, absolute, permanent reality. This kind of deliberate thinking, conscious exploration, using reflective thought can be a very, very helpful way to know, directly to awaken to the empty nature of those perceptions. Any questions, thoughts? Anybody there?
Yes. About that is, it's to me, if I tried this, it would be a lot of thinking, actually. Oh, it would feel like that, like a normal thinking, in a way. Like, or perhaps should it be done when the mind is more calm?
Mm-hmm.
After some, maybe anapana or whatever. Because if I really, it's just like now, I would be thinking about the silence, or it wouldn't be very deep in a way.
Yes.
Or it would still feel conceptual, even the perception of silence or the general idea would be kind of conceptual, I don't know.
Yeah, it works most effectively as a practice if there's a basis of calm. So you start off with establishing as much inner quietness as possible, so that it's like with the temple. You know, you pick up all the cushions, you sweep the floor, and then you put the cushions out. You make a clear, open space, and have things as tidy, as clear, and as open as possible, and then. In that inner quietness and inner spaciousness, if it's just another little word, you know, like you just jamming today is Thursday in the midst of a whole kind of crowd of people and activity and the chaos, it doesn't really have an effect. There's no space around it. So to bring the mind to as much quietness and steadiness and stillness as possible, and then also relaxation of the body using the physical. Relaxation, physical ease, that's very, very helpful, because the relaxation, the stability of the body strongly supports the relaxation and stability of the mind as well. So that if we spend at the beginning of a meditation period, spending a good amount of time establishing the posture, really relaxing as fully and completely as possible, then you're focusing the attention and the body and the mind is creating a basis of calm and spaciousness, quietness, to the extent possible. And then, you say, deliberately picking up an exercise like this. And then if the mind does tend to be chattery and busy, then it's really important to start with as bland a statement as you can. Like, today is Thursday. I mean, maybe if the day of the week is something got an emotional charge, you know, choose something else. Thursday, yes, you know. It's my day off the washing up, you know. But then just choose something else so that you're just using a very, very simple phrase, really just developing that skill of this is another perceptual object, that's all. And then, as Longpo's describing in this, noticing the space before, and then there's the form of the thought, and then there's the space after. And then as that's developed and there's more skill around that, then you can notice how even when the form of the word is there, or the few words are there, you still have a sense of the space around them. Like, just like, you know, you can see a visual object, you can see the microphone and the bar, and then there's the rest of the space of the temple around that and the people and so on. As you're thinking the words, you know, today is Thursday, that doesn't fill the whole attention. There's a sense of, okay, there's those thoughts, but the basic spaciousness of the mind is not interrupted by that. And so then as that's developed, and in particularly in supporting Vipassana meditation and being mindful and aware of thought in arising and passing away in Vipassana, then a flow of thought or a memory or an idea can take shape, but there's a sense of perspective on that. Yeah, that thought is there, but it doesn't occlude, it doesn't mask the space of the mind. The spaciousness of the mind is uninterrupted by the presence of that thought. And then, as he's describing again, things that are more emotionally charged, more personal, things that you're excited by, things that you're irritated by, things that you've got doubts about, you're worried about, then you're more and more able to feel and to know those in exactly the same way. Yes, they're there. They have a particular tone, like with food. It's like, yes, this is a particular flavor, and it's like the mind then, oh, this is a taste I really don't like. Okay. This is a taste I really like. Okay. And the taste doesn't disappear, but in a mysterious way, that when you work with the mind like this and you train it not to add anything to those perceptions, you're able to kind of enjoy or to be more really appreciative of what's there. You don't have to kind of grab hold of the things you like or get away from the things you dislike. It's just, oh, it's just this. And so in a way, it makes it even more enjoyable because you're not getting sort of lost in the commentary about it. But I do recommend that often with meditation, because it seems to be such a mental, an area of mental activity, and like I was saying a couple of days ago about the body, if the body isn't hurting, we can kind of forget that it's having an influence. And so it's another of Lumpur Sumedho's teachings that I found extremely helpful over the years. He would emphasize to really put attention on the posture and settle into the posture and recognize the importance of balancing energy and relaxation in the posture before you get onto the mental realm. And it's kind of the more active and eager the mind is to get going on the practice, it's okay. All very well. Now, what's the body doing? Yeah. How does it feel? Because we can work, in a way, very hard to try and quiet the mind and not realize that the body is sort of is full of agitation. It's creating agitated reactions in the mental world. And if the body is settled and relaxed and balanced, really at ease, then it strongly supports that quality of ease in the mental world as well. Gaspar, did you have a question you were going to ask?
Thank you. Yes, I did. partly motivated by the silence. And so I was like, okay, I do have some questions, so maybe I can just ask this one. But since I have the microphone, I might as well sort of proceed. So I was just sort of playing around with this idea of how would it be to grow up in an environment where one would sort of lack certain concepts. Like, for example, an infant is growing in a culture where they don't have reference to themselves or a word for an I or a word for to have. And then I was just thinking, it seems to be there is a internal knowing which exists independently of the actual tokens of meaning. So words are sort of merely just sort of abstractions of this inner knowing. And I guess I'm wondering, it's kind of like a chicken and the egg thing. Is there an innate sense of sort of self that is independent of the abstraction? Or is it the case that as we grow up, we are sort of reinforced and fed back through these sort of tokens of meaning? Oh, it's you, you have, you own, etc. I don't know if this was clear enough, but I trust that you at least understand a part of it. Thank
you. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's an interesting question. My understanding and my experience is that we're very heavily influenced by our conditioning as we grow up, you know, as human beings or in the animal world, by the family that we grow up in, the group that we're a part of, whether we have a family or we don't have a family, the language that we use, and so on and so forth. I mean, there are human communities where they don't have pronouns like we have in European languages, like she, he, they, we. They have verbs of doing, but the pronouns don't really function. There aren't really pronouns in the same kind of way. There's like there's talking, or but there you don't say I am talking I am talking to you, and the mind doesn't form those kind of fixed separate entities. Other languages, they don't have nouns. So there isn't person, there's personing, and there isn't book, there's booking. So you just have adverbs and verbs. You don't really have things. You know, I often talk about some of these languages like Hopi and Navajo and this particular tribal group in South America, the Piraha, and they have radically different concepts of time. And personhood, like you can't talk about a person who's not present. Like if Gaspar walks out of the temple, there's no way of talking about Gaspar because he's not here. That's a sweeping statement, but that kind of thing. That where I was thinking, well, Gaspar is here today, you know, or that you can't talk about events in the past that you weren't a personal witness of. Or like in the language of the Piraha, which is I find really extraordinary, they have no fixed words for color. They have no concept of number. They're very functional as a community. They have their verb forms. They're like tens of thousands of verb forms and such like. And they work very comfortably and easily together with each other. But the whole way that they frame their lives and they consider who and what they are. It's just formed very, very, very differently and reflected in their language. And the book that I read about this is called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. The fellow who wrote it is an American missionary. He really had to learn how to think like the people of the tribe before he could learn their language, because the language just... You couldn't function in terms of, pronouns, verbs, subject, object. It was not their world. So I feel it's very much the case that what we think of as self and the way we think of I and you and he and she and we and so on, these are the particular patterns of them are formed very heavily out of our familiar relationships. Also, people who have different mental abilities that sometimes are just because of the brain structure or particular conditioning from infancy, they can't form a sense of self. They feel pleasure, they feel pain, but the word I doesn't have I has no meaning. Or like of a little baby, you know, who's like 6 months old, they have no language in many ways, but they feel pain, they feel pleasure, they know what's familiar, what's unfamiliar, they know smells, and they haven't got a word for it, but they know it. Their life is guided by those things. So I think one of the things with Dhamma practice is that it's kind of hope if it's working, it's extremely humbling, because as we grow up into adulthood and we say maybe we encounter Dhamma in our adulthood, we come into it thinking, yeah, I know what the world is. I know who I am, and I know. And we don't realize that this world and the way that it's formed and this person is heavily conditioned and structured around our background, our family, our language, our education. And so we think that what we experience is the world. And that as Dhamma practice is developed, there's more and more of that humbling experience of, oh, no, this is just one very heavily conditioned version that my mind calls the world. This is really just this being's putting together of a version of the world and the experiencer. And that I feel is an essential part of the development of insight, is that humility, recognizing that just because my mind sees it this way, it doesn't make it true or real or the one genuine version. It's just one perspective on experience, one way of understanding reality. You know, and for many human communities, and even just like living in northeast Thailand, in the sort of rural village life of northeast Thailand, their relationship to the individual and individual excellence, you know, is very, very different from what we have in the West. So, I mean, I couldn't understand the language particularly well, but talking with the people there and, you know, one or two of the monks, particularly Ajahn Prabhakara, who was the abbot there, had really, really good command of the local dialect. And so he really understood the local value system very directly and acutely from connecting with the local villagers. And so... as a community, the village is the most important thing. Then comes your family. Then comes you as a person. So whether you are particularly good at something, like you're particularly, strong, or you're good with sewing or with numbers, or if you're proud of that, or you think that you're somebody special because you're a really good sewer, or you're really good at doing your mathematics, then if you sort of feel like you stand out, then people generally think of you as a bit of an idiot. And if you're someone who's selfish or puts himself first, even if you might come from a sort of very reputable family in the village, or you have quite a lot of money, people think, oh, poor bloke, you know, poor guy, yeah, this man is impoverished because he thinks he's special. And somebody who is always looking out, always ready to volunteer to help with the rice planting or fixing somebody's roof, or is kind of ready to lend a hand with the village life, and has a strong community consciousness, you know, whether they are particularly wealthy or strong or good looking, it doesn't matter at all, because they'll be someone who's loved and respected because they've got a community sense. And so that was really interesting. And it's not something that's forced. It's really that they grow up with that. They learn that from early childhood, and that putting your family, thinking your family is more important than the other families of the village. Again, people think, oh, poor, you know, poor fools, you know. Why do they think they're so special, poor things? And that, not in a condescending way, but it just like in a, as if there was some kind of illness, you know, that, oh, you know, they got a bad infection. How unfortunate. And so that was, as I encountered that over the first few months of living there back in the late 70s, it was like, wow, that's a really different way of operating than growing up in the West, where, you know, you being the sort of the top of the class or getting a first class degree or winning the race or being the best dancer or whatever, oh, you know, that's something that's praised or revered, or that you get that kind of points, so social strokes for. It was completely different, so that was something that you can see is coming right from the earliest conditioning, and so that their world, what is beautiful, what's ugly, what's inspiring, what's depressing, is very, very different. The awareness that knows it, I would say, is exactly the same. Just like the oxygen that we breathe is exactly the same, or the sunlight that falls on our skin is the same, or the force of gravity on our bodies is a non-personal natural quality. So at its very root, the awareness that knows these different patterns of conditioning is the same, I would say. But the content and the processes of conditioning is radically different. So it's to say, again, going back to the Piraha, I remember, you know, if you function in the, you know, in the general sort of academic world, and you think in terms of knowledge and science and information and such like, you know, people would say that the ultimate language of the universe is mathematics. For the Piraha, they don't use numbers. Numbers have no meaning. So they, you know, this fellow was this missionary was trying to teach them, and he said how about, and some of them were interested. I think we think this might be useful, so we're really going to try hard on this. And he would explain, okay, this is, you know, one. You have like sort of three or four sticks, and he'd say, okay, this is one stick. This is two sticks. You know, this is three sticks. And they say, well, that one's got more knobs on it than that one. That one's longer than that one. They could see, they could obviously see the differences, but he's saying, "Well, there's two," and they say, "Yeah, that one's shorter than that one." And if you really reflect on it, when you say, "You know, what is one? What is two?" It's like, "Well, two what?" You know, two planets. Oh, it's that idea of oneness or two-ness or three-ness. Oh, it's something that the thinking mind is adding on to, you can say, two objects, a book and a clock. Well, okay, there's two, but one's a book, one's a clock. There's just one way of designating some kind of quality, but it doesn't have any substance. There's no thing really there. And so that... I feel, in terms of developing insight, that it's really good to take those kind of things in and realize, oh, sanya anicca, perceptions are imperfect. They are uncertain. They're not absolute. And things like in number, time, identity, these are all. Things that are given solidity by the attitude of the mind. And the more that the insight is developed, is recognized, there isn't really anything there. The thingness is a function of the attitude of mind. That, there are these perceptions and communications, and real changes can be brought about by those perceptions and the way the mind it works. But so much of it is recognizing the fundamentally empty nature of every perception, and things that we take to be true and solid and real, like I, time, number, place, individuality, these are impressions. They're seemings. There's no thing absolutely there. And that the development of insight is a stepping down from those conceits of, you know, I understand, I know, this is the world. This is beautiful, that's ugly, this is right, that's wrong, this is mine, that's yours. And it recognizes, well, those only can be convenient fictions. They only can be subjective impressions. There's no absolute thing there. So the mind stops giving it an absolute solidity, and then it is able to see things more accurately in their true light. And that, just as I was saying, the more that we sort of let go of that delicious taste and stop getting drunk on it, we actually can, in a way, enjoy the taste more. Because the mind isn't creating anything around it. So that seeing the empty nature of perceptions and the five khandhas, in a mysterious way, it enables the heart to be more fully and completely attuned to the way things are by having let go of the way things are. And that's really the core of Buddhist practice is around that, that the Buddha is the embodiment of having completely let go of the world. His whole nature, his mind, his heart is totally attuned to the world and to the living beings around. So maybe just read a little bit more. In contemplating the Four Noble Truths, you have the truth of suffering, its arising, its cessation, and then the path. You can't know the path and the way out of suffering until you are aware of where everything ceases, in the mind itself. The mind is still vital and alert, even when there's no thought in it, but if you don't notice that, you believe that you're always thinking. That's the way it seems. You only conceive of yourself when you're thinking, because you're identified with memory and the sense of I am or I am not. That yourself, quote unquote, is very much a conditioned, programmed perception in the mind. As long as you believe in that perception and never question it, you'll always believe that you are an obsessive thinker and that you shouldn't be this way, or you shouldn't feel that way, you shouldn't worry. But you do, and you're a hopeless case. So it goes on from one thing to another. So I am, quote unquote, is just a perception, really. It arises in the mind and it ceases in the mind. When it ceases, note that cessation of thought. Make that cessation, that empty mind, a sign rather than just creating more things in the emptiness. You can get refined states of consciousness by fixing on refined objects, as in samatha meditation practices that emphasize calming the mind. But with the contemplation of the noble truths, you're using the wisdom faculty to note where everything ceases. And yet when the mind is empty, the senses are still all right. It's not like being in a trance, totally oblivious to everything. Your mind is open, empty, or you might call it whole, complete, bright. Then you can take anything, like a fearful thought. You can take it, deliberately think it, and see it as just another condition of the mind rather than a psychological problem. It arises, it ceases. There's nothing in it, nothing in any thought. It's just a movement in the mind, and therefore it's not a person. You make it personal by attaching to it, believing it. And I'm such a hopeless case. I know I can never be enlightened. After all the things I've done, the stupid things, I'm so selfish and I've made so many mistakes. I know there's no hope for me. All that arises and ceases in the mind. So I think it's a very good... the set of reflections to close on for today, that it is challenging. You have I would not underestimate the kind of quickness. You've got to be sort of quick on your feet mentally to sort of, in a sense, keep track of those creations and judgments and the way that self-view and I am, I'm this, I'm not that, how easily and quickly that all takes shape. But the more that there can be that sort of quickness or alertness, that watchfulness, then we find there's great spaciousness. And also, as Dunpo puts it here, your mind is open, empty, or you might call it whole, complete, bright. And so Lumpu Cha used the same kind of expression. You know, he would say, we call it emptiness, but we say the mind is empty, but actually that means it's full of wisdom. So even words like empty are conditional. They're just ways of speaking. So that the empty mind is empty of thingness, you know, the mind is not creating solid thoughts and people and objects, but it's full. It's full of wisdom. It's full of that light of knowing, and that seeing of how these things happen. The mind makes a judgment. This is great. This is beautiful, and then gets lost in it, and say, okay, the mind is getting caught. Then to let go and to see, oh, this is just the mind attaching to a pleasant, inspired feeling, or when there's criticism or self-aversion and such like, to recognize, oh, here's the mind is just attaching to that, believing in it, and that just over and over and over and over again, with endless amounts of patience, just seeing how these creations and habits, these judgments of mind, that they're nothing solid, there's nothing absolute there, and when they're not given that solidity by the attitude, by the habit, then there's what remains is spaciousness, peacefulness, and clarity. So let's leave it there for today.